Twilight of the Gods, The Mayan Calendar and the Return of the Extraterrestrials, by Eric von Daniken, translated by Nicholas Quaintmere, narrated by Kirby Hayborn. Copyright 2010 by Eric von Daniken. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Career Press and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Keep listening after Twilight of the Gods, The Mayan Calendar, and the Return of the Extraterrestrials for a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken. Foreword. What is a cargo cult? The term refers to the real-life ethnological phenomenon of what happens when a technologically primitive society comes in contact with a technologically more advanced society. On countless documented occasions, ethnologists have observed that if technologically advanced visitors live among technologically, not intellectually, primitive cultures for short periods of time and then leave, soon thereafter, the visitors' advanced nuts and bolts technologies cause the native population to view these rather ordinary humans as gods and begin to worship them. On many occasions during their stay, the visitors would interact with the native population, giving them goods and food, cargo. After the departure of these gods, the native culture surmised that they would return if they practiced intense worship, sacrifice, and emulation. Examples of modern-day cargo cult behavior can be found in the regions of the South Pacific during World War II. Why is this phenomenon so important? It is important because if cargo cult behavior still takes place today, then it is a rather logical conclusion that cargo cult behavior also took place thousands and thousands of years ago. The cargo cult phenomenon illustrates the basic premise of the classic ancient astronaut theory. Thousands and thousands of years ago, technologically advanced flesh and blood extraterrestrials arrived on Earth in nuts and bolts spaceships. Intellectually speaking, our ancestors were not stupid. They essentially had the same brain as we have today. However, because their technological frame of reference was limited, they did not comprehend the nuts and bolts aspects behind the arrival of those flesh and blood extraterrestrials, and so our ancestors misinterpreted them as being divine in nature, which, of course, the visitors were not. And thus, the gods were born, out of a simple yet major misunderstanding. According to the ancient texts and traditions, a long, long time ago, the gods, lowercase g, descended from the sky and instructed mankind in various disciplines. Why is it so hard for us to believe, living in a culture so rich in metaphor, that our ancestors drew similar comparisons? Is it really such a stretch of the imagination that whatever is described in the ancient texts is nothing more than the description of misunderstood flesh-and-blood extraterrestrials who arrived here in nuts-and-bolts spaceships? Mainstream science believes it is. They believe that all of these ancient stories and traditions are a figment of our ancestors' imagination, and that all of those legends were nothing but fantasy. But can something really be created out of thin air? For many years, I attended an international boarding school high up in the mountains of Switzerland. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, our school welcomed a few new students from the former USSR. I remember sitting in art class, and our assignment for the day was to draw a fantasy castle, a dream castle, floating in the clouds with shining towers and magnificent architectural features. The assigned project sent the entire classroom into a tizzy, and we started drawing with unbridled enthusiasm. Everyone, that is, except our three new Russian classmates. None of them touched their pencils. They just sat in front of their large, empty sheets of paper. "What's wrong?" the teacher asked. "Why aren't you drawing?" The students replied, "What's a fantasy castle? What does it look like?" We've never seen one. Since we've never seen one, we can't draw it. What an extraordinary reaction. This incident underscores one point. If something has not been seen, then it cannot be invented. Translation, it is impossible to conjure up something out of thin air if the basic elements are missing. Nothing happens without the initial spark of inspiration, without a catalyst. Therefore, mythologies, legends, tales, whatever, which mainstream science today discredits as mere fantasy inventions of our ancestors' imagination, cannot possibly all be unfounded inventions or mere figments of someone's imagination. Quite on the contrary, something had to be there in the first place to act as the catalyst, the basic element that sparked the story. Something happened to our ancestors. They witnessed something that compelled them to tell of these events in their traditions. I think we'd all have to agree that it is impossible to create, let alone solve, an algebraic equation without knowing the basics of mathematics. It cannot be done. In this scenario, the basic mathematical elements represent the aforementioned initial spark, the catalyst. Everything else follows quite naturally afterward. It is said that each legend has a true core. It is this core that represents the base element, the catalyst. Without a base element or initial inspiration, nothing is possible. Therefore, if something like this happened to my Russian classmates living in the 20th century, then why couldn't something similar have happened to our ancestors many thousands of years ago? The ancient astronaut theory shows that it has. We must remind ourselves that when all of these legends and stories first were written down, the art of writing itself was a fairly new invention. Our ancestors realized very quickly that this new invention was the most powerful tool with which to preserve important knowledge. Is it really logical to think that the first stories and legends put in writing by our ancestors were only figments of their imagination? Of course not. Why? Our ancestors lived in a time fraught with uncertainty and upheaval. The most important order of the day was raw survival, the gathering of food, finding of shelter. So it is a logical conclusion that the first people empowered with the written word had better things to do than to sit around a fire, get drunk, and invent fantasy stories. What story shall we conjure up tonight so we can painstakingly carve this stuff into stone? But that is exactly what mainstream science proposes. All ancient stories are made up so that the storytellers could come to grips with the world and its surroundings. I consider this type of thinking to be an insult to the intelligence of our ancestors. I hear the ancient astronaut theory is insulting to our ancestors because it undermines human ingenuity. I ask you, who exactly is insulting our ancestors' intelligence and ingenuity by pompously insisting that the records of our ancestors are false, or that they made mistakes in recording some dates, etc.? It is most certainly not the ancient astronaut theory. With the invention of the written word, for the first time in human history, people were able to permanently record the most significant events of their time. Just like we have newspapers and books today in which we report about things that are important to us, why would it have been any different for our ancestors? For example, Native Americans still today refer to a train as a fire horse, a throwback to a time when they did not have the word train in their vocabulary. The same applies to the things and events our ancestors wrote down. They had no way of calling a flying object by the words aircraft or plane, so they did the next best thing. They described it with objects with which they were most familiar in their everyday lives. Misunderstood technology. So if there are detailed, intricate descriptions of beings that descended from the sky on flying shields or fiery chariots and taught ancient humanity in various academic disciplines in the remote past, then we must start to explore these accounts from another perspective. What they immortalized at the time was their history, their lives. They diligently recorded and attempted to circumscribe events that really happened to them or their ancestors. Little did they know that future scientists would relegate their writings into the realm of symbolism and fantasy. That type of pompous attitude shows a great disrespect to our ancestors, not the idea that extraterrestrials showed up here on Earth thousands of years ago. 500 years from now, after establishing permanent bases on the Moon and Mars, humanity will venture out to explore deep space. One of our generation spaceships will eventually arrive at a planet harboring intelligent life. What if the intelligent life we encounter turns out to be technologically primitive? What will we do? Will we just stand back and study them from afar? Yes, maybe for a month or two. But then, after we have studied and mastered their language, as ethnologists do every day, we will make physical contact with them because, well, that's what we do. We poke and prod at things because we can't help ourselves. We will interfere with their cultural development. We will guide their technological direction. We will give them a gentle push. We will teach them a few things. We will make them aware of the essentials of science and various academic disciplines. And many, many generations after our departure, our ancient visit will be regarded as myth and fantasy, because accounts of our visit in ancient texts will be deemed as unscientific by the oh-so-smart scientists of that society. A long time ago, the gods descended from the sky and taught our forefathers, etc. By now, that society will also have reached such an advanced technological development that it now readies itself to go into deep space. But our physical visit will be regarded as a figment of their ancestors' imagination and relegated into the realm of quirky mythology because it is preposterous to read ancient history as recordings of actual events. Remind you of anyone? And thus the cycle begins anew. One day in the not-too-distant future, we too will become ancient astronauts ourselves on some faraway planet. So why couldn't this have happened here on Earth thousands and thousands of years ago? The answer is self-evident, and it's time we shed our arrogant attitude and open our minds to what really happened in our cosmic past. With my very best regards, Giorgio A. Tsoukalos, Director, Center for Ancient Astronaut Research, AASRA, Publisher, Legendary Times Magazine. Preface. So how did it all begin? Let's turn the clock back around 65 years. We find ourselves in a primary school in the town of Schaffhausen, Switzerland. And there I am. I'm 10 years old and listening to my religious education teacher describe a battle that took place up in heaven. And here's how it went. One day, the archangel Lucifer and his heavenly host marched up to the throne of God and declared, "We will serve you no longer." Thereupon, the Almighty God ordered his archangel Michael to expel Lucifer and his entire gang of hangers-on out of heaven forever. Since then, my teacher explained, Lucifer has been the devil, and all of his followers have roasted in the infernal fires of hell. Well, this certainly gave me something to ponder about, and that evening, perhaps for the first time in my life, I sat down and did some really serious thinking. Heaven, we had always been told, was a place of absolute bliss, a sanctuary where all good people would head off to after shuffling off this mortal coil. It was also the place where all souls would spend eternity in heavenly unity with God. So how could a quarrel like this come about in paradise, where all is bathed in divine happiness and where perfect unity with God abounds. Surely discord would be completely impossible in a place like that, wouldn't it? Why should Lucifer and his angels suddenly take up arms against the Almighty and benevolent God? I went to my mother and asked her advice, but she couldn't come up with a satisfactory response either. In God's realm, she said, groping for some kind of answer, everything is possible. And that seems to be it. Everything is possible, even the impossible. When I was 16, I was sent to a boarding school run by Jesuits. We learned Latin and Greek, and I realized that the word Lucifer derived from two words, lux, light, and fere, bear, carry. So Lucifer actually means bringer or bearer of light. The devil, of all people, the bringer of light? My new knowledge of Latin just made the matter all the more confusing. 10 years later, I had studied the Old Testament, as Christians call the ancient text, in great depth. This is what I read in the book of the prophet Isaiah from around 740 BC. Oh, how you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn! How you have fallen to earth and laid the nations low! For you said in your heart, I will go up to heaven, will make my seat higher than the stars of God. I will take my place on the mountain of the meeting place of the gods. Isaiah chapter 14, verses 12 to 13. Most likely, the sayings of the prophet Isaiah have changed somewhat over the millennia. So what was their original meaning? If you look a little further, you'll find another clear reference to war in paradise. And there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels went out to fight with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels made war, and they were overcome, and there was no more place for them in heaven. Revelation chapter 12, verse 7. Battles in heaven? In space, perhaps? Were our unknowing forefathers simply trying to express the inner struggle between good and evil that takes place in all of us? Did they misinterpret the atmospheric battle that rages during a thunderstorm as a war in the heavens? The dark clouds against the sun? Or was the root of their confusion a solar eclipse where it seemed that something monstrous was devouring the sun? All of these naturalistic explanations, however, don't quite cut the mustard, as I later realized after comparing these writings with ancient texts from other cultures. Greek mythology, for instance, also begins with a heavenly battle. According to the Greeks, the children of Ouranos rejected heavenly order and their creator. This led to terrible bloodshed, and Zeus, the father of the gods, was just one of the victors. All the way over on the other side of the world, and a long way away from Greece, lies New Zealand. Its original residents, the Maori, have legends that also begin with a heavenly war. Again, a group of the gods' children rebelled against their fathers. The leader of those heavenly warriors was called Rongomai, and after his victory, he settled with his people on the earth. You can imagine how my sensitive young psyche was thrown into confusion as I was given the task of translating chapter 19, verse 12, and following, of Exodus from the Old Testament. I read how the Lord descended to a mountain in Exodus, chapter 19, verse 18, and following. Mount Sinai was swathed in smoke, because the Lord had come down on it in fire, and the smoke ascended like the smoke from a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. Let me make one thing clear. I have always believed in God, and I still pray regularly. But my dear God has to have certain qualities. He is timeless. In other words, he doesn't need to do experiments and wait to see how they turn out. He knows already. He is almighty and omnipresent. He doesn't need any kind of vehicle to move from point A to B. Why should God need some kind of flaming carriage to descend onto a mountain and reduce everything to fire and smoke, so much so that the mountain shakes. The very mountain that Moses was required to fence off for safety reasons. What on earth is being described here? Later, I read the experiences of the prophet Ezekiel in the Bible. He also described a vehicle with wings, wheels, and metal legs that caused an awful noise and threw sand up into the air. The Lord's chariot throne? My dear God doesn't ride around in that kind of vehicle. To be honest, I find it insulting to the omnipresent God to maintain that He would be so insignificant that He would need to use any kind of transport at all. Suddenly, I was plagued with doubts about my own religion. As a young man, I wanted to know if other ancient peoples told the same kind of strange stories as the Israelites in the Bible. And that's where it all started. I got stuck in and began researching. Thus began a fascinating life that has been filled with ups and downs and has taken me halfway across the world. It has led me to visit the world's greatest libraries. It has caused me to seek out and talk to many highly educated and intelligent people. It has moved me to visit countless archaeological excavations. And, last but not least, it inspired me to start writing. I wrote my very first book, Chariots of the Gods, at the tender age of 33, while I was still working full-time as the director of a top-class hotel. Twilight of the Gods is my 25th nonfiction book. Add to that my collaborations on 7 anthologies and, just on the side, the 6 novels I've written, and you've got quite a collection. I've had a bit of fun recently counting up all the nonfiction pages I've published. 8,342 pages. Looks like a number you might see on a check. 8,342 pages. Would you believe it? Doesn't the guy ever run out of things to say? Surely he must repeat himself quite a lot. To be honest, the reason that it never gets boring is because the material just keeps coming and coming. The field I work in never stops getting more exciting and more up-to-date. Increasing numbers of authors and scientists are becoming fascinated by the subject, and that's not really any great surprise. After all, the thought that extraterrestrials were here thousands of years ago is one that touches on a whole range of different scientific fields. So what are we talking about? Well, it involves prehistory, archaeology, philology, especially linguistics, ethnology, evolution, genetics, philosophy, astronomy, astrophysics, exobiology, space travel, and, of course, one mustn't forget, theology. Repetitions? Well, they're impossible to avoid completely. For instance, I already dedicated 12 pages in my book, The Stones of Kiribati, to the enigmatic ruins in Pumapunku in the highlands of Bolivia. And now I've come back to the subject. Why, you ask? Well, it's like this. In the past, I dealt with Pumapunku more like a journalist. I reported on it and presented a number of pictures without ever really going into any depth on the subject. But this time, I'd like to document what it was that left the very first visitors breathless and stammering as they stood before the mighty stone blocks of Pumapunku 400 years ago. I'd like to show you what archaeologists discovered hundreds of years ago and demonstrate how much has been destroyed throughout the centuries, intentionally. But I will also prove that Pumapunku was not built by any Stone Age people. And in December 2012, the gods will return from their long journey and appear again here on Earth. At least, that is what the Mayan calendar and Mayan written and oral lore would have us believe. This time, I've gone into greater depth than ever before. The so-called gods, in other words, the extraterrestrials, will come again. We're in store for a god shock of major proportions. Doesn't anyone with half a brain know that interstellar travel is simply impossible and is likely to remain so because of the huge distances between the stars, and that extraterrestrials would never look like us? Well, my dear listeners, I destroy these preconceptions systematically, one little piece at a time. I hope you enjoy hearing about it. Yours, Eric von Daniken, September 2009.